Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to one of the most joyous and fun movies ever produced. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Yes, this is the outlaw John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, and host, and voiceover artist, and massive Gene Kelly fan here in San Diego, California.
How many times have you just been on YouTube or something and gone, I'm going to watch a number from Singing in the Rain?
A lot. There have been a lot of nights, a lot of days where I've just put on Moses Supposes His Toes Are Roses, Singing in the Rain itself, which is still the most beautifully staged musical number, simplistic yet grandiose in its approach. And I was humming it today as it's been raining for the last 5 days. I got out of bed humming it today. So it's a film that still works for me, still affects me. And there's such a majesty and simplicity at the same time in this movie, and the beautiful romance between Gene Kelly and Debbie Reynolds. Just incredible stuff going on in this movie that still holds up all these years later, Steve.
That's just what I was going to say. You know, it's like everyone talks about the incredible dance numbers, as they should. Everyone talks about Singing in the Rain, as they should. Everyone talks about the comedy. They talk about Make 'Em Laugh. They talk about the love of Hollywood history and coming out of the silent era and all that stuff. And those are all great things to talk about with Singing in the Rain. I don't think people spend enough time talking about what a perfect little love story this is.
Yeah. Someone who is initially seen as, you know, the artist who is kind of highfalutin and arrogant, and that would be Debbie Reynolds, who thinks it should be a certain way, which is the irony here. And then you have Don Lockwood, who is established already and a superstar, and everyone loves him, and he's a movie star, but he longs to be accepted for who he actually is. He longs to reveal himself to someone and be vulnerable and show who he really is behind the Hollywood facade. And it takes a little bit of time before him and Debbie Reynolds finally put down both of their walls so they can connect and care for each other. And it's not even fully cemented until the final scenes of the movie when the curtain is raised and the conversation happens. And I love that about this movie, that this love story is touching and brilliant, but it's always in question up until the final moments.
It's a great way to put it. And I hadn't thought about it until you were just speaking, but their relationship starts with them both putting up facades and lying to each other and not being themselves. And the movie ends with the curtain going up and revealing who they both really are.
Yeah.
Like that it is a fantastic movie. For me, it might be the single most joyous film I know of. And I will anytime put on exactly the same set of songs that you mentioned. And so I can't wait for all of you to jump back into the world of Gene Kelly, Debbie Reynolds, and Donald O'Connor in Singing in the Rain.
Enjoy.
Welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film. We explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a directing instructor and filmmaker in Los Angeles, California.
Happy New Year, everybody. I don't know how many weeks you are out of that one, but I'm just going to say that now.
It's always nice to say Happy
right?
New Year.
I think we're still in that area that I can. Hi, I'm John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist, host of numerous shows here in LA, and an occasional actor as well.
And we're very happy to welcome Milena Govich, who is a Broadway actress, singer, dancer, and you might have seen her on Law & Order, on Finding Carter, and Rescue Me. Milena, welcome to The Cinephiles.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're really happy to have you, and we're particularly happy to have you today because we're going to talk about musicals.
I love musicals!
and unfortunately, there's sort of a sad way that we got into this, which is, look, as everyone knows, 2016 was rough.
Really rough.
It was a very difficult
brutal
year. Yeah, brutal. And we could go on and on and on about the actors and writers and singers and dancers and important people in our lives that we've lost. And it seemed like the knockout blow at the end of the year was in 2 days losing Carrie Fisher and the day after her mom, Debbie Reynolds. And it was just beautiful and brutal and shocking and...
It was completely heartbreaking.
Yeah. It really was. And we might get into talking about Carrie Fisher a little later on a different episode of The Cinephiles. Yeah. But today we really wanted to talk about Debbie Reynolds. And it gives us an opportunity for as sad as 2016 was, to have one of what I think might be the most joyous movie I can think of, which is Singing in the Rain.
And yeah. Especially her performance, too. Oh, I mean, she's absolutely. Just living.
Absolutely. She is 100% joyful and bubbling and charismatic. And it's also, Singing in the Rain's my favorite dance movie by far. But
dance movie, you say?
Yeah.
Not musical.
Well, just in terms of, I literally have, a part of it is that I teach them, but also I will pull up on YouTube, make them laugh, or Moses Supposes anytime. I've shown them to my kid over and over and over again. Good morning.
Yeah.
Singing in the Rain. They're just, and nothing. They just make me smile.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, because we have, when did you start dancing, Melina?
I was basically dancing out of the womb.
It seems very slippery.
Okay, well, you know, how you get good core strength and balance.
I guess so.
That's gross. Anyway, I started training when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I trained classical ballet my whole life, essentially. I missed most pop culture of the 80s and 90s because I was in a dance studio 25 hours a week after school. I love dance, and I knew I was never going to be a ballerina because I, at 5'8", am the tiniest person in my family. But on Broadway, they love tall girls who have curves and also have classical dance training. So sure. That's where I found my niche dance-wise.
And what was your first show on Broadway?
My first show was Cabaret at Studio 54, directed by Sam Mendes and Rob Marshall.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah, that's also how I got my Equity card. It's a pretty...
wow, way to go.
It's a pretty lucky story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're doing Fosse dancing then.
Well, it was Rob Marshall's choreography. However, it was steeped in the Fosse world. Yeah. I mean, you can't do Cabaret without paying homage to Bob Fosse.
Yeah.
So it was a little... It wasn't the original choreography, but it was very similar. Very down, raw... harsh, which was actually hard for me as a trained ballet dancer because everything is lifted and very graceful. Mm-hmm. And now I'm being asked to dance with my crotch.
Right.
So that was a great learning experience for me.
And was that the first time you'd had to make a transition like that? Or had you done other styles?
I'd done other styles, but this was a really specific style. It was, and very, specific to the show itself and the time period it was taking place in and the heaviness of the subject matter. So that was different for me.
So, and while you were missing all of the pop culture going on when you were a kid, did you miss Singing in the Rain too? When did you
It? Oh no. Singing in the Rain was playing in my house whenever it would come on the, in Oklahoma, the, public station was OETA and they would play old movies, especially on the weekends. And my parents always had them on. And so I saw it many times. Probably it was longer before I actually saw the whole movie start to finish.
Right.
But yeah, very familiar with it growing up.
And what about you? Do you remember when you first saw it?
Yeah, I'm sure I saw it as a child on PBS or something. I remember I became a massive Gene Kelly fan as a child, like just massive. Like everything he did, I watched. And as I got older and I was able to have access to stuff that wasn't showing popularly all the time, I would like It's Always Fair Weather, The Pirate, you know, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, all these things. I'm like behind Orson Welles, Gene Kelly is my second favorite actor, celebrity, entertainer, period. It just, there was something about
what
his...
What a weird combo.
It is, because for whatever reason I had, I am a frustrated music, song and dance man, which means I never had the training and I don't have the voice. But if I could, if I had Melina's talents, Melina's abilities, I would have done this till I was dead. I would have been a musical theater actor touring till I was dead, because it's just something I love to do and I don't have the skill or ability to do it.
Right.
So I could live out my dreams through Gene Kelly, and because his dance was something I could connect to. Fred Astaire, not so much. Fred Astaire is fantastic, but it's very elevated dancing.
They're very
soft
different.
Shoe. Yeah. Soft shoe. Whereas Kelly, to me, was always blood and guts. It was barbed wire and broken glass. It was down in there. It was more grunty, and so I could relate to it more. The moves were more powerful, more dazzling, and so to me, that was what really stood out. And his characters were never like these high evolutionary characters. There were these always down on their luck, don't have a lot of money, especially with Singing in the Rain. He is a stuntman. He's a stuntman. He grew up poor, which we see in the beginning, like all this kind of, so there was a lot of what Kelly did with his characters that really I gravitated to. And so I would enjoy the music and the dance through connecting to the character and then going from there and enjoying the movie. And Singing in the Rain, I remember seeing as a child with my mom and dad, and then just would see it all the time because there's such a joy in that dancing in the rain, singing in the rain particular number that for me as a kid was like, oh, my eyes were like wide open to see something like that and was like, oh my God. And it became one of my favorite musicals ever.
It's strange. This might sound very, very strange, but the way I first came to dance and loving dance, I fell in love with that almost exactly the same time I fell in love with martial arts and martial arts movies.
Oh, that makes sense.
And it was the for me there, it was the same. So I watched, you know, Enter the Dragon the first time I was 9, and I probably saw Singing in the Rain and my first Fred Astaire and, you know, Holiday Inn and all those films probably right around the same time. And there's something about the elegance and the beauty of the human body in movement that I just love.
I think Gene Kelly would have loved to have heard you say that, given his reverence for athleticism and dance at the same time. I think he'd be thrilled to hear that.
Yeah. Well, and he wanted to, I mean, one of his big things was to, he wanted dance to be masculine,
you know,
and he said that quite a lot. And you can see in the way that he moves. And it's interesting too, when you think about the great male dancers and you think of Fred Astaire and you think of Gene Kelly, or you think of the Nicholas brothers who are just off the charts amazing, or you think of Gregory Hines or Baryshnikov and every or Sammy Davis Jr. and every single one of them, they move like they move.
Yeah.
They don't move like anybody, or Savion Glover, or all of them are just, that guy moves like that.
Yeah.
And you could see Gene Kelly's style of movement, and I think maybe because of martial arts that he was my guy too.
Well, I think all of that was really intentional for Gene Kelly. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't want to be the regal, elegant Fred Astaire.
Right.
He really wanted his dance and his movement to translate more to the everyman, so that you could sit and watch it and go, I could do that, or I relate to what this character is going through, not only through the story and the dialogue, but also through the physical movement. And I love the fact that his shirt sleeves are always rolled up.
Yeah. Right.
You know, he's still in his white pants and his, you know, his preppy vest, but the shirt sleeves are up. And so, you know, you're connecting to him in a different way than you would if someone like Fred Astaire.
Yeah, absolutely. And he said that if he tried to put on a tuxedo and dance like Fred Astaire, he'd look like the plumber had snuck in. and it very much comes from his background. He grew up in Pittsburgh, and his parents pushed him to dance at a young age along with his brother, and he really resisted. He didn't want to do it, and he was getting beat up at school and called names that I'm not going to go into what those names were, but he really resented it. He wanted to play baseball. He quit dance. He played baseball. He went, I'm going to go be a baseball player. And he was apparently, you know, I mean, the guy's obviously gifted in movement in every single way.
I'd put him at shortstop. No question.
But then he keeps coming back to dance. And in high school, he starts coming back more and more. And his family opens up a dance school. Mm-hmm. And he becomes a dance instructor and begins doing choreography in high school and goes to college. Then he goes to law school, which I didn't actually know until I was just reading up on him. But in law school, and he did sort of his first theatrical productions while in college. And in law school, he keeps getting pulled back to dance. And after a few months of law school, he drops out and decides, no, I'm going to be a dancer. And what's so interesting to me about him is there are all sorts of choreographers who began as dancers. It's very normal. That's obviously the path. Gene Kelly was a choreographer from the beginning, from high school and college. And right after, he was teaching dance and doing choreography and was sought after as much for those things as he was for being a performer himself. And in his very early 20s, he goes, okay, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to go to Broadway. And he goes and nothing.
Yeah.
And it's a complete failure. And he goes back to Pittsburgh. And it's back in Pittsburgh where he starts to really build up his reputation as a choreographer, becomes sort of bigger and bigger, then returns to New York a second time. And this is the time that it hits. Mm-hmm. And the big one, I think, for him is Pal Joey. And that's where he really starts to, and he's choreographing over here and he's dancing over here. And sometimes he's dancing in other people's choreography, sometimes in his own. Comes to Hollywood, and again, it's a little bit of a struggle in the early 40s for him. He does enlist in the military in World War II, as a lot of actors did at that time. Yep. He was in the Navy and comes back. And it's really with those Frank Sinatra movies, Anchors Away, On the Town. Those are the ones that really he starts to hit. And that's when his choreography and his own style starts to emerge.
Well, he's also challenged, right? Because Frank wasn't a dancer. He had to teach Frank how to dance. You know, he had to teach him how to move. And he adjusted. He had to adjust his choreography.
Right. You had to find a way to make it work.
Exactly. And because Frank was, you could argue, was a bigger star than Gene was. So Gene had to kind of make that work in their films. And On the Town is one of my absolute favorite films. I own it in every possible version it's ever been in, from beta to high-end Blu-ray. I own it because it's just so much fun and so joyful. And the songs don't get enough love. The songs are so good in On the Town, and nobody gives them enough love. And it's the same thing with Take Me Out to the Ballgame. There's some great songs in those musicals that don't get as much love as Singing in the Rain or West Side Story, other musicals that you hear songs from.
And On the Town is really important because it's the first musical shot on location in New York. It really brings musicals out of kind of the backlot way that they had been shot in the past. And we have to remember that this is in the height of the studio era. Right. This is the height of the MGM musical. He's mostly working at MGM. And we'll talk about it a bunch throughout this film, but MGM the way they made movies then is completely different from how we made movies now. And there's a lot of things that are bad about the studio system. And there's a lot of things I really miss about it. So let's get into Singing in the Rain.
Let's do.
So the origin story, this is sort of strange because the way musicals happen from the 50s on, like post Rodgers and Hammerstein, is that we create all the songs for the musical. Everything is within the characters. That is not how this movie gets made.
No, this is one of the premier jukebox musicals that there ever was.
Mm-hmm. All these songs already existed. Yeah. It's Arthur Freed, who's the producer, who was kind of ran his own sort of mini group at MGM. And he said, I've got all these songs. Let's do something to them. And that's how the movie gets made.
Well, it's great when you go back and watch these documentaries like That's Entertainment. There was one, two, and three. Like when you watch one and two, you see the songs that are in Singing in the Rain when they were originally done in the 20s and 30s, the numbers that were done, like the Busby Berkeley type stuff, which is one of the things I enjoy about the movie. The movie has such reverence for old Hollywood and the old Hollywood musicals.
And yet it's still poking fun at the same time.
Exactly. It's incredibly subversive. If rewatching it this time, it's incredibly subversive and making fun of itself and Hollywood itself. And all of it could apply to 2016
no
or 2017.
Question.
All of it could apply, from the woman ignoring Donald O'Connor when he shows up to, because the bigger star is coming, to the crap profiles that they create to make it seem like the star is humbly arriving when you know the truth behind the story. There's just so much there. You know?
Well, that opening sequence is so great and so, just as you say, so subversive, because we have this Gene Kelly, you know, Don Lockwood is going to tell his story, and he's telling it in this completely fake way, and he keeps saying, oh, it's always dignity.
Well, Dora, I've had one motto which I've always lived by. Dignity. Always dignity. This was instilled in me by Mom and Dad from the very beginning. They sent me to the finest schools, including dancing school. That's where I first met Cosmo. And with him, I used to perform for all of Mom and Dad's society friends.
And then you get to see the reality behind that. Yeah. And it's perfect juxtaposition. And it's perfect destruction of everything he's saying. You know, like, all of this is a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's in all white, which I love.
Well, yeah.
The idea that he's in all white, which means he's pure and innocent, when in fact he's lying. There's all
and
of it.
And it's a fabulous idea. I mean, I don't know exactly, but from what I know, Comden and Green came up with this concept of, for the book of the show, to be a satire. And since all the music was actually written during the time period of the Busby Berkeley and all of that, it worked perfectly for this kind of story. So it was a really smart adaptation of the existing material.
Well, and to some degree, they're sending up older Hollywood, which maybe gives them a little liberty.
Right.
You know, they're not setting up 1952 Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And we should say, too, by the way, this is coming right after, 1 year after American in Paris. So Gene Kelly has just done what was up to that time the biggest movie of his career. It's, in terms of awards, the most successful movie of his career. Mm-hmm. And it's not that American in Paris is heavy, but compared to Singing in the Rain, it's a more like, we're doing a more serious thing.
That's why that's why it's my favorite of his.
American Paris.
Oh, absolutely. The ballet itself is so powerful. And there's so much in that film that is dark and and sad and difficult and painful through the whole thing. It's unrequited love through the whole film. Mm-hmm. This is more happy, playful, bouncy, discovery, these kinds of things, miscommunication. But American in Paris is, and it's why I won Best Picture. It's a darker, more serious musical.
This is why I like Singing in the Rain better, because I'm a more happy, bouncy person than you, and you are more serious.
Okay, I accept that. I will accept that.
No one has ever described me as happy or bouncy.
We're all laughing at that comment for a reason.
So it's all these songs pulled from other places, and we are right at the end of the silent era. And as a guy who loves film history, I'm literally teaching film school today, and the subject came up of the difference between CinemaScope and Cinerama, why. Uh-huh. And I just wanted to started talking, and they kept asking me questions. So got in this whole lecture of how we went from silent to sound and different kinds of perforations on film edges and all these kind of geeky things that I really love. Mm-hmm. And so it's so fun to watch this moment in the silent era. Yeah. And while this is a completely silly movie, it's pretty accurate too.
Yeah.
You know, like there's the scene where they're filming multiple silent films right next to each other and different directors. That's how they did it. Because that's how you could do that in a silent film.
Right. And it looks ridiculous in this day
and
age.
Totally ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. And the style of acting that we have, which is this sort of big, broad acting with text and these very huge romantic movies, that was for real too.
And that's a good segue, I think, into Debbie Reynolds, because, I mean, that's what she does in that car, is essentially making fun of everything that Don Lockwood, what you're talking about, the pantomime acting, the whole thing that she's that's going on there in the car. And you see that, and it's so funny. Because she's not wrong.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, no offense. Movies are entertaining enough for the masses, but the personalities on the screen just don't impress me. I mean, they don't talk, they don't act, they just make a lot of dumb show.
You mean like what I do?
Well, yes. Here we are at sunset in Camden.
Because she's not wrong.
Exactly.
But that time in that era, when you go back and watch those silent films, you see it's a lot of big faces and a big movements and that have you. And
I will subtitle the moment where you didn't hear anything, because Roka did some beautiful silent movie acting.
It's very impressive.
What's particularly funny too with Debbie Reynolds in that scene. Yeah. So Don Lockwood, Gene Kelly's character, has just gone from his hugely successful premiere. He runs away from his fans, climbing up on a car, on a bus. And by the way,
does his own stunt.
Gene Kelly would have made a great action star.
Absolutely.
I would argue that he is an action star.
Sure, I agree. Fair. But let me put it differently. I wish he was around today and we could put him in a great action.
Yeah.
Can you imagine him in a big superhero movie?
That would be amazing.
I always think that's one of the crimes that he never got a chance to do as much out of musicals as he could have, as he should have. You know, you see Inherit the Wind, he has a part in that, but like it would have been awesome to see him in an action film to do these kinds of movements and what could work, you know, whatever.
And he drops into Debbie Reynolds' car. She doesn't recognize him at first, that she does, and then she plays very sort of snooty, looking down on him, which is, as you say, really funny, and then doubly funny because we find out she's a big fan.
And only after...
Much later,
he comes on to her. That's when she becomes.
You're
snooty.
Right. You're right.
Yeah. Much
She's
later.
Nice to him until he takes advantage of her. He tries to take advantage of her. Then she fights back. Yeah, she should.
And by the way, who is he? That who does he become when he comes on to her?
Oh, he starts to put on the persona.
The Hollywood.
Idiot. The lie.
Guy. Exactly the same full of it guy that we saw at the beginning of the thing.
Well, we movie stars get the glory. I guess we have to take the little heartaches that go with it. People think we lead lives of glamour and romance, but we're really lonely. Terribly lonely.
Exactly. And that is why, of course, she should reject him, because that's not who he is.
Right.
We get to this big premiere party, and in comes the cake, and out of the cake, who should pop out but very cute Debbie Reynolds.
That is one of my favorite screenshots of her ever, is coming out of that cake. I mean... You can't buy that kind of effervescence and joy and pureness of spirit. I mean, she just leaps off the screen.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk a little bit about Debbie Reynolds, who, you know, this is the whole reason we did this, is sadly we lost her just a few weeks ago. You know, she comes from Texas. She moves to Burbank. Her family is working class, fairly, very religious. She lives in a very kind of controlled upbringing. She's a Girl Scout. She's a gymnast. She becomes Miss Burbank. Mm. She's a beautiful singing voice. And she gets hired by MGM. She's in one movie where she does pretty well. And then Louis B. Mayer tells Gene Kelly, this is going to be your co-star in Singing the Rain.
Right.
Gene Kelly says she has no dance experience, which he didn't. No, zero dance experience. And Louis B. Mayer repeats, this is going to be your co-star in Singing the Rain. And then Debbie Reynolds has to learn how to dance.
Yeah, it's a monumental undertaking for her. But fortunately, with her gymnastics background, you know, she was coordinated. She knew how to pick up a routine and all of that. And so she had good body awareness. And
but could you who started doing ballet at five.
Yeah, but you know what? I didn't come to tap dance till much, much later. I didn't start studying tap till I was in college. So I was actually probably the same age as Debbie Reynolds when I started tap dancing.
And could you in 6 months have picked up Good Morning? And
she is doing really difficult steps. Really?
Up and down the stairs?
Oh, and to keep pace with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor, that is not nothing.
Yeah.
What she accomplished in those two numbers in particular was phenomenal. Mm. And she is toe-to-toe with those guys. So
absolutely.
And also she got, even in the more balletic number, You Were Meant for Me. She does a beautiful job. Yeah. And some of that upper body work can be just as difficult as all the intricate footwork because you have to look effortless. And that's one thing I love about Gene Kelly is because no matter what he's doing, it's the most athletic dancing you've ever seen, but he's floating and he's delivering an emotional performance on top of it. You never feel like he's jerking around or anything. So he was able to teach her that. And from what I know of Debbie Reynolds, that whole experience shaped her. Mm-hmm. And it taught her the kind of work ethic that kept her performing.
Right up until
basically the day she died. I mean, she's still going to Vegas every year and, you know, well into her 80s. And,
What she did at that time is, you know, 6 months where she moved into the studio.
Yes.
She put a
She's
cot.
19. She's 19.
19 years old. She puts a cot in her dressing room. She lives there the whole time. Her feet are regularly bleeding.
Yeah.
And there's one story I heard.
Spoiler, that's not unusual for dancers.
I can't. Yeah. I can't imagine. Because when my feet start bleeding, I sit down.
I was like, well, there's the difference, Steve.
Yeah. I guess that's why I never...
Dancers are tough.
They're tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super tough. I mean, this is something... I remember I was watching So You Think You Can Dance, and they had some... And sure, this was kind of BS a little bit, but they had some people come in with all sorts of body measurement metric things to test where dancers were on the scale of athletes. And of course, it was off the charts.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of heart rate, endurance, flexibility, oxygen in the lungs, you know, all, you know, strength, speed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, again, it's you're asking these people to do the most athletic thing they can possibly do and also make it look effortless.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's no like huffing and puffing at the end or grinching up your face to lift the heaviest thing. I mean, you could be a male dancer lifting your female partner who may not be the lightest feather, but you got to make it look effortless, you know?
Yeah,
there's a moment, and you know, Debbie Reynolds in those 6 months had to get to that point where she could hold her own with those people. And there's one moment that she says where she was crying under a piano one day alone in the studio, and who walks in but Fred Astaire.
Oh, wow.
And Fred Astaire finds her and basically says something like, the only way to be a great dancer is through great pain.
That's true. true. My ballet teacher used to say, if it doesn't hurt, you're not doing it right.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's funny for this thing, you know, for those of you who maybe you didn't grow up taking dance classes, maybe you haven't met dancers, is that the impression that they give on the stage of grace and effortlessness and joy and lightness is nothing to do with what it takes to get there.
Yeah.
Just Google ballerina feet.
It's
awful.
Should we put a warning on that?
Anyway, yeah.
I mean, maybe don't actually do that. I don't know what's going to come up exactly, but.
And what's interesting is they have a high tolerance for pain and don't like to be fussed over. Like that's the thing I've discovered in my interactions with dancers. The natural, when they're in pain, the natural desire to help or fix is not welcomed because there's a badge of honor in the toughness, in the feat, in the pain, in the bleeding, in whatever it is that they earn through the work that they're doing to achieve what they want to achieve, and they don't want to be fussed over about it.
Well, the last thing accepted. You want is for someone to watch your performance and go, "Wow, you are you okay?"
Yeah, right.
No, it's the opposite of what you want to come off in a performance.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's training, it's hard work, it's endurance. Boy, the endurance levels. I mean, if you think about these dance numbers, it's not like, oh, well, we learned the dance, let's do the dance and now go to lunch.
Yeah.
I mean, take after take, something like 40 takes of the Good Morning number. There's a story about them doing the end of that where they tip over the couches. Mm-hmm. And just getting that right, it took forever to get the timing right, and all three of them just going over at exactly the same moment. Talk about athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unbelievable. So we meet Kathy Seldon, and we see her do this All I Do Is Dream of You.
All I do is dream of you the whole night through. With the dawn, I still go on dreaming of you. You're every thought, you're everything, you're every song I ever sing. Summer, winter, autumn, and spring.
And it is so bright. And cute. And she has to do, again, really interesting acting, which is be 100% in the dance number and also be embarrassed to have been discovered by Don Lockwood in this lie.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And which culminates, of course, in him trying to talk to her because he really likes her at this point. And she tries to throw some cake in his face and hits someone we have not spoken about yet, which is Lena Lamont, played by
Gene Hagen.
And she is amazing.
If we bring a little joy into your humdrum life, it makes us feel as though our hard work ain't been in vain for nothing.
So good.
Oh, she's fantastic. She's perfect in this part.
Right. Especially because she doesn't speak that way.
Yeah.
So she has to put that on to play that part. And what's fantastic is when I was watching it this time around, I thought, oh, could you look at this as a misogynistic film because they're kind of putting her down? But no. She has her way of forcing her power or pushing her power throughout the film so that although they are making fun of her and they do come after her, she has these street smarts that she uses in certain moments to achieve and maintain her status and fight for her status in Hollywood.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, she's using the skills and the tools that she has to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, as an actress, you know, there are moments in the movie where you're like, oh, God, please. But but at the same time, you have to ask yourself the question, what is this character willing to risk to hang on to her career?
Right.
You know, and in a hypothetical world, what would Lena Lamont do after this? You know, she's kind of got no other choice.
Right.
Well, and this is a real thing. So we're in this moment. It's the end of the silent era.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of casualties at the end of the silent
era. Sure.
Including how films were made. So one of the really interesting things is that silent films really reached a peak in the late 20s. And the techniques were really sophisticated in terms of the filmmaking. We might have made fun of some of the acting earlier, but there's some gorgeous, amazing silent films made in this era. And as soon as you introduce sound, because that's what happens in Singing in the Rain, is that all of that sophistication has to go away, because now in order to do sound recording, you can't have these camera moves because they didn't have the equipment to do it. You had to have these big booths to record sound, and everything had to get locked down. And so the technique of filmmaking went back about 10 years when we introduced sound. And then you have all these actors who might have been fantastic silent actors, but some of them couldn't even speak English well, you know, and so they had to go away. They were lost. And that's what Lena Lamont is facing at this point in the movie.
Yeah, I actually have empathy for her, you know, in that regard.
A little. She's a really bad person.
She maybe goes about it the wrong way.
She's not nice. I mean, she clearly wants to destroy Kathy Seldon for the incident with the cake.
Right.
But
not just for that, but because she feels the challenge.
She's threatened.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And Don Lockwood, Gene Kelly's character, is desperately looking for her and really sad. And who's going to come make him feel a little bit better but his good friend, Donald O'Connor?
Cosmo.
Short people have long faces. And long people have short faces. Big people have little humor, and little people have no humor at all.
And in the words of that immortal bard, Samuel J. Snodgrass, as he was about to be led to the guillotine...
Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Or you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite. And you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh.
This is my favorite Donald O'Connor performance, bar none.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Just so amazing and so much fun. And you get that understanding why he never became a lead, even though he's probably technically a better dancer than almost anyone that's ever been on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't have quite that gravitas to be a lead.
Well, he's,
but he's does great work as a second.
Yeah, but yeah, there's nobody that can do what he does better.
Yep.
Just bar none. I dare any professional athlete anywhere on this planet to try to do make him laugh like Donald O'Connor. Yeah. My God. That is one of the most genius numbers on screen, I think, ever. For a solo guy. I mean, and he does everything.
Yeah.
He does everything. And I don't know, 2/3 of the way through the number, I don't know how he's still getting up off the floor.
Yeah. he literally seems like, I'm going to destroy myself for your amusement. Yeah. Just beating himself to pieces. And the athleticism and the intensity and the yeah, it's amazing what he does in that number.
Yeah.
He runs up a wall, for God's sake.
It gets really, I've watched that a lot. I see a lot of guys do flips off walls. He gets really high.
Yeah.
He's like three steps up.
No, if you just look where his last footfall is and then where his head is once he lands again, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And not only the athleticism and all the tricks, but the timing.
Oh,
his comedic timing is so spot on. The part in the number where his face is all crooked and it's just boom, boom,
amazing.
Boom on a dime. It's so clean and so funny, but it doesn't feel anticipated at the same time. It really feels like it's organically coming from him and his clown persona.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who also has coached a lot of young musical theater performers, and it's not something you can teach.
Mm.
Either you've got it or you don't. It's just got to be innate, and he has it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and just let me also say, one of the most difficult things to do is to get a trained dancer to dance badly. Just like a trained singer to sing badly.
Right.
His training is clearly impeccable based on the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But to do those silly pratfalls and to make it look real
and
to be really
off
difficult.
Balance and awkward and on the wrong foot. And
And then not injure yourself doing it.
Right.
That's incredibly difficult.
And avoid the wood and jump through the wall and all these things and climb out. I mean, all of it is just, it was a show. It was like, I will take the part, but I need one number where I can show everything that I can do, because you're not going to let me do it because Gene is the star. And that is a perfect exchange that you can make for that.
And from what I know, that was, Gene Kelly was a big champion of this idea of giving him a big showcase number because he is so talented.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were very good friends and they really went through the vaudeville canon to create this number. All the shtick that he had ever done as a child star, as a child dancer, whatever worked at one point in time, let's figure out a way to kitchen sink it into this number.
Yeah.
Well, and that's sort of what this film is a lot, is that we get a lot of kitchen sinking. I like that expression.
Yeah.
You know, of old Hollywood shtick. And we're going to do, because we're going to have Ziegfeld-ness, and we're going to have Busby Berkeley-ness, and we're going to pull out all the stuff for the film. So Don is looking for Kathy. He can't find her. And then it ends up she's working at his studio.
Yeah.
And this is what's really interesting. In most movies, most romantic movies, we're going to have love come together in Act 3.
Right. Uh-huh.
This one has it happen kind of the end of Act 1, is that he takes her and he says, I have something important to say to you, and I can't say it. And it's so interesting, this level of artifice versus reality.
Yeah.
I can't say it in the real world. I have to take you to the movie world.
Yeah.
And he takes her and puts thousands of watts on her and a wind machine.
Oh, I love this number so much. It's so just blatantly romantic and beautiful.
So we find Kathy Seldon. She's going to come back. We're going to do a sound picture. And then we get to watch the recording of sound. And I have to say that we have this sequence where we're actually recording sound, and everything is going terrible.
So funny.
So great.
And the first the microphones in the plant, and then we put it on her chest, and we get her heartbeat, and then it's on her side, and sound is in and out, and the pearls, and all these things are happening, and you watch the director getting more and more crazy.
Hold it a second. Now, Lena, look. Here's the mic, right here in the bush.
Yeah.
Now you talk towards it. The sound goes through the cable to the box. A man records it on a big record in wax. But you have to talk into the mic first, in the bush. I'll try it again.
Jesus, this is dumb.
Oh, she'll get it, Dexter. Look, Lena, don't worry. We're all a little nervous the first day. Everything's going to be okay. Oh, by the way, Roscoe, you know the scene coming up where I say, Imperious Princess of the Night? I don't like those lines there. Is it all right if I just say what I always do? I love you, I love you, I love you.
Sure. Anyway, it's comfortable. But into the bush! Okay, again. Quiet! Roll 'em!
That's what directing feels like. A lot of the time. It's like, I have to stay really calm. Everything's falling apart around me. I stay calm and we're just going to get through it. It's going to be okay. Yeah, that's really what it feels like to be a director.
By the way, that actor is an unsung hero of the film.
Oh, he's great.
So great.
Oh, yeah.
Just so great. Just say it into the mic, into the bush. I don't care what you say. Just say it into the bush. It's so great.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
And of course, one of the things we have to do in order to do a talkie picture is that our actors have to learn how to speak. Yeah. So on the one hand, we have Lena Lamont with her voice coach. And I can't stand him. She's such a good voice. Yeah. And then with the guys, we get Moses Supposes.
Oh my gosh, this is such a terrific number.
Yeah.
And it is one of two songs in the whole movie that were actually original to Singing in the Rain. It's not one of the trunk songs from previous shows. It's a very...
And the other one's Make Him Laugh, right?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Make Him Laugh, which is based...
It's pretty much...
Cole Porter song. Yeah, but, yeah. But nobody... They deny that, but that's okay. But Comden and Green, again, they did such a fabulous job. And the lyrics are so... They're just the epitome of the Comden and Green wordplay mm-hmm. that they love to do.
Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
But Moses, he noses, his toeses aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toeses to be.
Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
A mose is a mose.
A rose is a rose.
A toes is a toes.
Hoop-de-doody-doodle.
And what I love about this number, there's so many things I love about it, but the choreography really matches the lyrics, mm-hmm. as far as kind of the canon aspect of it, because you get all these different rhythmic and syllabic matches in the lyric, and you get the same kind of call and response in the choreography as well, the way that
never thought about it. You're totally right.
Yeah. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch, and it's what's to me, it's like the textbook of, you watch two guys dancing really tightly in sync with each other, and yet they're different.
Yes.
And that's so fascinating to watch, is that they're doing exactly the same steps. They're perfect, spot on in sync. Mm-hmm. And yet the styles still come out. And one of the things I'm fascinated with Gene Kelly, and we talked about his athleticism, we talked about that sort of physicality he has, is I'm kind of fascinated. I'm curious what you think about this, but with his upper body, mm-hmm. because his upper body, no matter what he's doing, remains solid and still in this way, as if he's not really, and maybe that's why he looks so effortless, but it's just, he has such control and such strength there that he can do all these things, and yet it's like nothing's happening.
Yeah, that comes squarely from classical ballet training. And he did study ballet extensively and loved ballet. And that's really where that training comes from. Well, I'm sure we'll jump to it later, but in the Broadway Melody ballet, you see it very clearly. He does this entrenant jump sequence where he's doing these big leaps in the air, and he just floats, and you're like, oh my gosh, he's way up high in the air. Yeah. But that's really that training, to have that center and that lifted quality. Even though he does feel down and dirty and gritty and rough a lot of the time, he always has this this energy right in his core that keeps it smooth, so he doesn't look like he's hurting or trying. Right. And that's really where the performance comes from. And as far as the two dancers being so in sync and yet feeling like they're different, those are two great actors.
Right.
And those differences are coming from a place of character. And there's a lot of young dancers out there, singers, musicians, actors, who think, if I just do the steps right, if I just sing the right notes, if I just say the right lines, I'm doing great. Well, those things are the barrier to entry.
Right, of course. And you have to do that.
Yeah, you have to do that. So what's the difference? It's somebody that can bring their own life to it and their point of view, and these two guys do it effortlessly. And I think you bring up a really good point. This is a great example of it. The degree of difficulty is off the charts, and yet we still see two very different characters, two very different people executing the same thing.
And they're having fun.
Yes. They're playing. They look like they're having the best time.
Yeah. And there's no difference when you, and this is a great point you bring up, Ellen, there's no difference between watching two actors having a fantastic scene together verbally. What you're watching in this musical number is two actors having a great scene with their feet, with their bodies. But there's a conversation going on
100%.
With their dance, and you can see it. And as they dance around, and then as they come together, and when they're coming together, and then when they're on the desk, like all of it, there's such joy. But you're right, Steve, each one has their style, and their style, they complement each other so well in this particular number so well, and you just enjoy it because of how much fun they're having, because it's two pros at the end. And also, like, if you strip it all away, it's two dance pros in a studio, in a dance studio, having a great time, you know?
Well, and the thing,
like jazz, it's almost like jazz.
The thing too that's interesting that just sort of occurred to me is we started with the artifice of the fake Don Lockwood in Hollywood. And that's the guy that Kathy Seldon rejects. Mm-hmm. And he's full of it. And now, and that's the guy who's prancing around with Lena Lamont in these silly silent films. This guy's dancing to Moses Supposes. That guy's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what this movie is about, is that no, you have to be that guy. You have to be yourself.
Right.
Because that guy is filled with joy and excitement and fun. And that's who we want to see. Not the Lena Lamont guy.
Right.
That's false. And really, in a lot of ways, this movie is all about getting past the false to the real, which is funny because it's a completely, not phony, but a completely silly movie in its construction. It's not a realistic movie in any way.
No, but that is the real truth, because then even in the kind of show within a show story of making this movie, the change in the movie all comes about because Don figures out what he himself really has to bring.
Yeah.
And that is the song and dance man aspect.
Yeah. What? Tell me about the, you had mentioned before something about the tapping and how they do the sound for the tapping.
Well, yeah. In making musicals, talking about how musicals are actually made, for musical numbers, the music itself, the songs, are normally pre-recorded.
Right.
Traditionally, yes. They're pre-recorded and then played back on set, and you would sing and dance along to the pre-recorded music. And this is really essential for sound syncing later on in the editorial process to make sure things match when you're doing multiple angles, multiple takes, all of that. But with the dance, tap dancing is really one of the only forms of dance that sound is really essential, right? <It's key. laughs> So it would be almost impossible to record the sounds of the dance and then try to physically match the sounds on set.
Right,
so, so the tap sounds are generally done in post-production in Foley. And if you look closely thinking about it, you'll see sequences like in the Moses Supposes, the guys are up dancing on the desk, right? They're tapping, tick, 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 tick. And then they jump down on the floor and it's tick, 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 tick. It's the exact same sound.
Right.
We're not hearing the desk sounds and then
of course.
The floor sounds.
Right.
It's all a consistent sound. It's also a consistent sound level no matter if we're in a tight shot or a wide shot.
Right.
You would think if you're farther away from the camera,
farther sound.
You would get a different sound. So they would boom the tap sounds for sync. But then later, the God bless the sound editors, got to place all the tap sounds. But what they would do is... I had dance Foley artists, mostly women who were tap dancers that were never credited in any of these movies.
Wow.
And they come in, you put down a board, you put mics in front of their feet. And just like you would do an ADR session as an actor where you come in and match your own dialogue, they are there matching the choreography and the tap sounds.
So they're doing tap Foley.
Tap Foley. Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
And there were multiple people that did this. Many of the stars, like Fred Astaire, would almost always do his own tap sounds, his own tap dubbing. He had an assistant that was very close to him that would occasionally do it if there was a conflict or he was, you know, unable to come. Gene Kelly almost always did his own as well. I'm sure Donald O'Connor did his own because he's so great. It's reported that Gene Kelly also did Debbie Reynolds. So, so she was doing all the dancing and she's hitting all her taps, but to do that so specifically clean, with three dancers
and to copy your taps from sound and visuals to match them. That's crazy.
That's we talked about degree of difficulty a little bit ago. This is off the charts as well. Another fun story is that in the Singing in the Rain number, if you think about it, if you're in tap shoes in water, you're not going to hear a clean click, 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 click.
Yeah, yeah. No. And you might slip and fall on your ass.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if it was because Gene Kelly was sick at the time or whatever. He actually didn't dub his own taps for that number. Mm. It was Carol Haney and Gwen Verdon.
Oh, Gwen Verdon.
Gwen Verdon from Fosse and...
Yes, yes.
Wow. And Grease.
Exactly.
Grease. Yes.
Yes.
And Sweet Charity all of that. Yeah, and Carol Haney, who's also a phenomenal Broadway dancer, who both of them assisted Jack Cole, who was like the father of American theater jazz and dance. And they both had assisted Gene Kelly at different times.
Wow.
And so they dubbed those steps. And the story goes that they had to do it in a tub of water. Because it was matching, but it was just really, really, really shallow. Cool. So they were still getting the splish splash sounds, but still the consistent tap sounds. Again, you go back and you watch the number, the tap sounds are consistent. Even if he's on the sidewalk, in the puddle, on a lamp.
That's crazy. Which brings us, of course, to the world premiere of The Dueling Cavalier, our silent film epic. And it is awesome.
Yeah.
The thunderstorm outside?
It's those pearls, Mr. Simpson.
I am the noblest lady of the court, second only to the queen. Yet I am the saddest of mortals in France.
Why, what is the matter, Lucy?
I'm so downhearted, Teresa. My father has me betrothed to the Baron de Lancefield, and I can't stand them.
Oh, such a bitch.
Sounds good and loud, huh?
Microphone was, boss.
I have empathy for sound designers everywhere watching that.
Oh, yeah. And that is real. Like, everything that happens, loud pearls and the breathing and all, if you listen to straight sound, particularly poorly recorded, it sounds like that. Yeah. That's why we have
Or actors that don't know what they're doing and they're setting down books on their line. And
Oh, God. As a voiceover guy doing auditions, you're so paranoid about every little sound when you're listening back to your own auditions before you send them in. So that's just seeing that sequence again was like giving me hives, because you're just like, oh, that would be the worst thing in the world. You hear something. Oh my God, why didn't I hear that when I was recording? And you hear that now when you play it back. You're like, how did that get in there? I got to start all over again. So you see things like that. It just made
well, insane. And I have this happen with my film students when they're looking at their films I'm listening to them. I'm like, you're in deep trouble here. And they go, what? What's wrong? And like, because they're not hearing it, because it takes a while.
Yeah.
Because they're focused on other things.
Yeah, say, close your eyes and listen.
So they have a disastrous premiere. Yeah. People are walking out of the movie. They feel their careers are ruined. And in this, there's a moment where the sound goes out of sync, in which Don's voice comes, or this guy's voice comes out of Lita Lamont's mouth.
It's so funny.
And it's really funny. And this is going to become important later. We go back to Don's ridiculously huge mansion.
Yes.
I know, right?
It apparently has Chateau. Couches like lined up all over. And he is really depressed, and he feels that he's been exposed for exactly the phony Kathy said he was. They're really depressed. And then we come up with the brilliant idea, which I think makes no sense whatsoever, but they come up with the brilliant idea of, let's turn that movie into a musical.
Yes.
Why don't you?
What?
Make a musical.
A musical? Sure. Make a musical. The new Don Lockwood. He yodels. He jumps about to music.
Oh, the only trouble is that after they released Dueling Cavalier, nobody had come to see me jump off the Woolworth building into a damp rag.
Well, why don't you turn the Dueling Cavalier into a musical?
Dueling Cavalier?
Sure. They've got 6 weeks before it's released.
Yeah. Add some songs and dances, trim the bad scenes, add a couple of new ones.
And you got it. Hey, I think it'll work.
Of course.
It's a cinch. You know, it may be crazy, but we're going to do it. The Dueling Cavalier is now a musical.
And they go, perfect. We'll just add some song and dance scenes, because that's easy enough to do.
Sure.
And we'll just take a couple of months, and then we'll have a musical. We'll be a big hit, and we sing Good Morning.
Yeah.
I feel this is my lucky day, March 23rd.
Oh, no, your lucky day is the 24th.
What do you mean the 24th?
It's 1:30 already. It's morning.
Yes. And what a lovely morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've talked the whole night through.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Good morning. Good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
When the band began to play, the stars were shining bright.
Now the milkman's on his way. It's too late to say goodnight.
So good morning. Good morning. Sunbeams will soon smile through. Good morning, good morning to you and you and you and you.
Which is one of the greatest threesomes you'll ever see on screen doing any kind of dance. And she is so good in
she's
this
She's just
sequence.
Delightful.
Yeah.
In it.
She
and,
is.
And she's
and at the center of it.
Anchoring. Yeah, so yeah. Saying, she anchors the whole piece from the whole, the soft dancing in the dress. And by the way, the costume, fantastic. What they're wearing perfectly fits for what they're doing and lets her flow easily through what she's doing in the different changes. And the way they play with the raincoats and the different variations of the different dances that they throw in there. All of it is old Hollywood. All of it is there.
Well, and also the so big long tracking shot that takes them from room to room to room. Yep. And it just captures the element of play.
Yeah.
And I find that throughout this movie, that there's so much joy, as you say, but there's so much playfulness too. And playing off of one another. And this whole sequence really highlights that.
Well, this is I'm so glad you said it. I was going to say exactly the same thing, because I had this theater teacher who, when we got really depressed with our bad plays or whatever, he said, it's called a play for a reason.
Right.
Is that it's supposed to be play. And this scene I mean, so is Moses. There's so much play in this movie. And this one, they bring up the raincoats and all the things they do is like they're having fun. And of course, we know that Debbie Reynolds' feet had to bleed to have this much fun. Like that. And that's this combination that I'm kind of fascinated by with Singing in the Rain, because everything I've heard about Gene Kelly, he worked hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He was a taskmaster. He was a perfectionist. Yeah. It doesn't sound like he was mean or abusive, but he was like, we're going to get this exactly right. So to create this show of joy and play and laughter, we're going to put in hour after hour and after hour of serious hard work and sweat.
Well, and that is truly when you really can have fun, when you're not thinking anymore, when you've rehearsed so much that the steps are ingrained in your body, and you don't have to worry about what comes next, or am I in line, or am I hitting my mark? You really can have that much joy if you're that prepared. And I think it's essential. You know, they could not have pulled off what they pulled off in this movie without working that hard.
Yeah. And it comes through, especially in a number like this, because you, even as a person who just has no dance experience or no dance knowledge, you watch what they're doing and you're amazed at the sequence, amazed at the movements, amazed at the speed of it. And how it changes, how the styles change throughout the whole sequence. And underlying it all is this belief that, yes, things can be better. Yes, there's an option. There's a possibility. Even in the darkest of nights, when the rain is there, when everything says you're not going to make it, there's that one friend who's like, no, no, if we do this and this and this, we can save it. And it's that old Hollywood gumption thing, which I love.
Well, and they're having so much fun. You feel like you want to jump in there and do it with them.
Of course.
Like, absolutely. I'll get up there. I'll stand on the stool.
Well, that's how they manipulate poor little children into being tortured for years and years in order to become dancers. It's because it looks like so much fun.
Pretty much.
I was thinking about something that I wanted to ask both of you. What do you think of Gene Kelly's voice?
Well, he has a lovely voice. It's not a traditionally great singing voice. I mean, he's not John Raitt or somebody like that, or even Frank Sinatra. But I think he's such a good actor, and he's so connected. His voice is so connected to him and his performance and his body. You totally buy it.
I love his voice. I have all his songs, and because once again, it's that connection of it's not a high-end voice. It's not a highfalutin voice. He is a man. This is how a man would sing. He's masculine. And this is how a masculine man would sing. And this is what I feel when I listen to him. So I like his voice a lot. And if you go, as I've said before, go find On the Town. That's Main Street is one of the most beautiful songs that you'll ever hear him sing, and takes full advantage of what he can do with his voice. You know, the talk singing that works for his type of, it just is so beautifully done in Main Street, and here in Singing in the Rain, the same thing. There's a reason that song is so iconic. It's not because he's got this amazing voice. It's because it's a voice that fits, and there's a joy and purity, organic purity to it that you gravitate to and love.
Well, and I think to me, because I totally agree, I think to me, he's honest.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's who he is. Mm-hmm. That's who he is.
Yep.
And so, and
it's not bad. He has training. I mean, he's not just
on
crooning away and kind of marginally singing. No, he's doing a really good job. He's being authentic to who he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, and it goes back to sort of, well, what are we going to see a movie for? And sometimes it's not for the perfect. Perfection is not actually what we generally want. Right. Or it's hard to describe.
Authenticity is what we want.
But he is who he is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about Singing in the Rain. Now, this is his most famous number of all time.
Yeah.
It is one of the most beloved numbers of all time. It's not the most difficult number. By the way, I think it's well-known sort of Hollywood lore that he had 103 fever when he did it. Mm-hmm. Shot day for night, so they have big black tarps over the top. Mm-hmm. They have pipes over the top. This is on the MGM backlot, so it's really shot outside. Shot it over 2 or 3 days.
Had to dig little holes in the street to make puddles.
Yeah. And apparently people had trouble running their water in Culver City while they're shooting. They're using so much water.
Right. And also, they couldn't understand why the suit was shrinking. It was wool.
Yeah.
So the suit would shrink. So they weren't able, so they had to finally figure out what type of material to use, because the suits kept shrinking through the number. So they had to make that change as well. So there was so much involved in creating this amazing masterpiece. And like you said, Steve, earlier, like, there's all this work to get what looks effortless and beautiful on screen. There's all this extra work behind the scenes.
Well, I think one of the many reasons why this is such an iconic number and why he's so remembered for this is that it plays directly into his MO as a choreographer. Mm. He, you know, while he was classically trained in all kinds of dance styles, has impeccable technique, he really didn't want to be bound to choreography or established steps. He wasn't interested in creating pieces that were just this step, now this step, then this step. He wanted to find things that were true to the moment, to the mood, and to the character. Mm-hmm. And he does moves in this number that are just stomping around.
Right.
Yeah. But that's just what splashing. We all did. Yeah. That's what we all did when we were kids. Mm-hmm. It's, for some of us, maybe still our temptation when it's a nice warm day and it's raining. But you're an adult. You're not going to go splashing in the puddles.
Right. I do. That's why I wear these big boots. They're waterproof. I'm glad
to hear it, Steve. But he gave himself permission to really just find the truth of the moment and do whatever came out of him and not be constrained by style or technique. And this number is just such a beautiful example of it. And I think that's why people really relate to it. They could see themselves up there doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And it goes back to that word play.
Yeah.
You know, it's play. And there's just little moments of him going towards the water spout and not, and yes, and then going full under it or stomping into the full stomp.
Yes. Yeah. And then getting caught by the cop.
And the shrug. And then even the little dainty way he pulls his feet and shakes his feet to get the little drops off mm-hmm. when he's completely soaked. It's just, it makes you smile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and there are all sorts of emotions that films can do. I don't know that anything that makes me like, oh, I'm happy.
This is what I want to say about that piece. Two things. The undercurrent of it is love. This is how sometimes you can feel love. This kind of joyful purity of finding someone that you care about so much and the joy of it beginning, right? That's what he's doing when he's dancing all around. She's helped him solve this huge problem that he thought his career was over. She showed him that it's not. She's with him. She's by his side. And he is finally fully in love with her, and that is conveyed in the dance. The dance is joyful, but it's joyful because he's in love.
Absolutely. And, 100%.
And that's why he reverts. One of the greatest things I ever read from a therapist was like, when you fall in love, you go back to being a child and what you wanted as a child, how you describe love as a child. And what he's doing is childlike, the stomping, the pushing of the water, the putting this, and I love the camera work. There's a second thing I want to say. The camera work in this, when it goes wide, when it gets close up, when it goes above him as the water is pouring on his face, there's a smile on all of it, jumping on the lamppost. All of it is childlike in its joy because he's going back to being in love. There's no walls here. There's no Don Lockwood fakeness. This is him finally finding someone that he can be in love with and expressing it so purely in dance, you know.
Completely. Mm-hmm. I wanted just something you mentioned about the camera work is that we talked a little bit. We talked about it when we talked about Bruce Lee. I think is the idea of, you know, with Fred Astaire, he wanted the camera to be top to bottom.
Yeah.
Jackie Chan wants the same thing, which is why I guess I connect martial arts and dance. Is that? But the goal is, I want you to see everything that I'm doing. You can't just, if you just see waist up, you miss all sorts of stuff. You say feet down, you miss what my hands are doing. So, and Gene Kelly did the same thing, but he was much more sophisticated in the way that he used the camera. Is that the camera's moving and dancing with, it's showing everything, but it's also moving and dancing with the actors, which makes it more dynamic than what you had seen before he came along. And we should mention at this point too, that he has a co-director, which is Stanley Donen. Who also is on the town, and
who he brought up,
Gene
made him.
And it makes sense because when you're on camera, you can't really know unless you're looking and watching the scene. You can't really know what's going on, and I think Gene, and it sounds like they had a
very contentious,
obviously constructive relationship.
Yeah.
Making the film.
Well, you need that person, and it can't just be in a musical with so much detailed and specific choreography and specific camera work. You can't leave it to your AD to say, you got it, or whatever. You need somebody that speaks both the language of dance and the language of film. Right. And Donen was really that for Kelly. And from what I know, Stanley Donen also had great ideas that, you know, he wasn't necessarily the driving force, but when he went on to do things on his own, he was very successful.
That's the thing you could argue is Donnan was the more successful director than Gene Kelly overall, because he does go on and do other great films.
I mean,
Kelly,
you look
Fault
at the barn raising sequence in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Sure. That is genius.
Yes.
That is beautifully. I mean, Stanley didn't choreograph that, but he shot it. He staged it. And
Michael Kidd did that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can't say he didn't bring anything to the table sure.
Well, and we can never know. I mean, that's the thing about collaborations is we can't know. Mm-hmm. We can look at what they go on to do separately.
But there's a reason Kelly brings Donnan into On the Town, because he sees. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Although they broke up over Singing in the Rain, he sees the talent that Donnan has, and which is why he trusts him to be his second set of eyes on the Town and then when they do Singing in the Rain. But Donnan also is discovering his own power, his own knowledge, his own work. So at that point, when the break happens, it's because they both kind of he created this entity. He has embraced his own entity, and now he's going off to do his own thing. And they can no longer collaborate because they're too powerful.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's a natural progression with a mentor and mentee.
Absolutely.
There comes a point where
you got to move on.
You got to assert yourself and start to find your own voice and your own vision apart from the person you've worked most closely with.
Mm-hmm. So we're almost at the finale, but now I have to bring up one thing that I didn't know until this last time watching it. And I'm just shocked that I never knew this, which is I never knew that's Rita Moreno playing Zelda.
Oh, yes. And
never
her
knew
stuff
it.
Got cut. She's supposed to have a big number and everything. Totally cut.
Yeah. I got one more for you.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the movie, the fan that faints is Leslie Caron.
I knew I recognized her, and I couldn't figure
it
out. That's amazing.
Gene had found her, and they had he brought her over and wanted her to have this small part, and then did this the faint. And that's Leslie Caron.
That's great.
Hilarious.
Yeah. That's great.
Wow. So we've come up with our plan. We're going to do a musical, and Kathy is going to sing and be Lena's voice. And so I love the pitch because I'm picturing the Dueling Cavalier. And then they're saying, we're going to have these song and dance numbers, and it's Young Hofer. And then we see, and I'm just going, okay, how could this possibly? This is the silliest thing I've ever heard. But we go to our big final dance number, which is Broadway Melody, which originally was going to be small.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be a small dance number. And then because of the success of American in Paris, they go, we need to have it got bigger and bigger and bigger until it's this huge number. Yeah. And it's really fun to watch. It's not my favorite in the film. Like, I mean, it's hard to pick favorites. Mm-hmm. My favorites are the ones we've already talked about.
Yeah.
But Broadway Melody is great.
Well, there's so many inventive things about it.
Oh, yeah.
Both stylistically, visually, choreographically, all coming together to tell this kind of odd little story.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, I have no idea how that fits into Dueling Cavaliers
at all.
But, you know, I don't care.
What's the gangster mall doing in there? What's the old Sid Charisse sequence?
Yeah.
You're like, what's this all about?
I just have to take 2 seconds for Sid Charisse because she is...
Take 10. She deserves it.
She is maybe one of my greatest dancing idols. She is, or like I mentioned when we started the podcast, I'm a very tall, curvy brunette who wanted to be a classical ballerina. And Sid Charisse, she danced with the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo when she was 14. She had a professional career as a ballerina. Up until World War II began and the company disbanded because of the war. Mm-hmm. So that's when she came to Hollywood. And, you know, her style and her technique, the ballet training comes through, but it's, you still always believe her in whatever she's doing.
Yeah.
And the vampiness, the seductress part. I mean, she does it like falling off a log.
Right.
Well, and all the character that comes through in her performance is huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the second you lay eyes on her, you know exactly who she is.
Yeah.
And you know that Don Lockwood or
whoever
we're going to call him in this dance montage.
The Dancing Cavalier.
He's met his match and then some.
Yeah.
There's a funny tidbit that's well known about Sid Charisse is that she had an insurance policy as the most expensive legs because I think it was Lloyd's of London insured her legs for $5 million.
No surprise.
Not worth every penny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he used her he worked with her a few times, you know, because Brigadoon.
Brigadoon.
And then also in It's Always Fair Weather, which is one of these really dark musicals.
It's really dark.
Nobody talks about.
And Bandwagon.
And Bandwagon, yes, exactly.
Huge sequence with her that's really dark.
Yeah.
And another fun tidbit is that she's 5'7".
Yeah.
She's taller than Gene Kelly.
Yes.
And he choreographed specifically to hide this fact. God bless the male ego. But he has, if you notice, when you go back and watch all of her stuff in this, she's always hinged at the hip. She's right. Deep. Her mm-hmm. legs are bent. She's slinking around. It's a character choice, yeah. but it's also another choice as well. And he uses all these levels with her. He puts her on the floor three different times.
Right.
You don't really see that in dance. That's a very modern dance, modern ballet sensibility, but mm-hmm. he's incorporating it into this sequence. And I think it works beautifully.
Well, that's, as you said before, Gene Kelly isn't bound by technique. He's happy to take from whatever is necessary to make this happen.
Or invent his own thing. And there's two main sequences of dance with her. She's in the green dress in the club. Right. And mm-hmm. then there's the white sequence where it's in his imagination. Mm-hmm. And he does another fun thing in that sequence, which is to put her up on stairs.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they are not even dancing on the same level. They do meet, but when they meet, she's falling into his arms. Mm-hmm.
Well, and dancing, I mean, that, you know, that veil.
Oh, my God.
It is so crazy.
It's like 60 feet long or something crazy like that.
And they have huge, huge wind machines going all the time. And the wind machines are angled at different places, and they're turning them up and down to get the veil to do at what angle they want it to do. Really hard. And, you know, from what Sid Cherie said, you know, she's wearing a sail, essentially.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, trying to dance into the wind with this giant sail on her back, it knocks her over and over again.
Yeah. I so wish there was B-roll footage of this whole
thing. Right?
Because that thing
tied them up. And
oh, my God. What a nightmare. I mean, I've done my share of props dancing, and there are times when you just are at your wit's end trying to deal with this damn prop, much less do the choreography, make it look effortless, be in the moment as the actor. Yeah. I just can't imagine what it was like to film that.
Well, and just on this for a moment, even the simplest prop in a movie is hard.
Yeah.
Like I wanted blood to drip into a sink when a guy is like washing his face. And getting the blood to drip in just the right place, you do it like 30 times. You know, no, that wasn't right. Clean the blood up. You know, like, you see all sorts of times where, you know, a coin falls into frame or something falls into frame or some glasses or something. 20, 30 takes.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's really, really hard. And I imagine that where people are moving and running and there's wind and twisting and all that. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. And Sid Cherie had just had birth. She just had a baby, like right before this. Wow. So she had to work off all the weight and then be doing this scene. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a great sequence. And again, we get that joy of Gotta Dance, mm-hmm. which is just so much fun.
Well, and the camera work too, mm-hmm. in this whole sequence. And we talked a little bit of camera work and some of the other numbers, but overall, he and Stanley Donen, however the duties fall, we will never know. They did a lot of great work creating different sizes of shots with the camera movement. So you're not going from a wide cutting into the medium or cutting into a close. When the camera's moving, you don't feel like you've missed anything.
Yeah.
And that was really important to Gene Kelly. And then also all these axis shifts. You know, all of a sudden we're watching, looking one direction, then all of a sudden, whoop, the camera switches 90 degrees, and we feel like we're in a whole other place, but we're really just in another corner of the room.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you've got people coming from one side to the other, and it's very cinematic choreography in that way. It's choreography that wouldn't work on a stage, on a proscenium. It's really specific to the medium. And so I really appreciate that as a dancer and a choreographer. As well.
Yeah.
The whole sequence, Broadway Melody sequence, is so weird because it's a scene within a movie. It's a movie within a movie within a movie that they haven't shot yet.
Yeah.
Because they haven't even done it. They're pitching the idea of the thing they're going to do, where we have within that scene a guy meet a girl, and then we have his fantasy. And so we have a fantasy within a scene, within a movie that we haven't made, that's within a movie that has nothing to do with our main characters, Kathy and Don.
Right.
It is, and it's a really long sequence.
And yet we're totally engrossed.
Totally engrossed. Mm-hmm. And this, and again, I love pointing this out as I teach my students all sorts of rules of what you're supposed to do in film. And over again, there are these great movies that go, nope. You don't have to do that. Because the real secret is, if it's good, you could do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
If the audience is on board, God bless.
You could do whatever. Yeah. You can take him once you got him. You can take him wherever you want.
Yeah.
And Gene Kelly can take you a lot of places. Yes. When he's dancing, I'll go, okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty much good to go with that.
Yeah.
So we're making the Dancing Cavalier, and the whole idea is that we're dubbing Kathy Seldon's voice for Lena Lamont.
Yeah, but the crazy thing is, when we hear the playback of Lena Lamont's now overdubbed voice, supposed to be Kathy Seldon, it's actually the actress Jean Hagen. It's just her normal voice. Yeah. The actress playing Lena Lamont. Really? It's just her. She's doing an affected voice as the Lena Lamont character,
right.
But then they just use her voice.
I wonder why do you think they did that? Why did they do that?
I don't really know, because we obviously know what Debbie Reynolds sounds like.
Yeah. And yet apparently we don't, because I never knew that.
Yeah. And the same thing for the singing as well. When we hear the playback of the new voice of Lena Lamont, that's not Debbie Reynolds either. It's another studio singer.
Wow.
And I regretfully don't remember the name of the singer that's doing it. And I'm not sure why they chose to do that, because, again, we clearly know what Debbie Reynolds sounds like singing.
Yeah.
Except, again, we clearly don't, because I never knew that.
Wow. Maybe they're trying to sell it to us as the more affected voice of the...
Well,
the movie.
The other thing that reminds me is like, well, this is the studio system. And today, if a studio is making a movie, a team is hired to make that movie for the studio.
Right.
In the days of the studio system, they were all there. And they went from movie to movie. And so, like, for instance, what happened with this film is whoever was necessary to bring in for that moment, they brought that person in. Like, one of them is that it's a different arranger for Moses Supposes than it is the arranger for Good Morning, because they went, oh, this guy's better for this kind of song. And because they're making so many movies, like MGM made more than two movies coming out a week, which is more movies than all of Hollywood makes now. And so they're constantly, it's like a factory, and all these people are going from movies to movies. And this is one of the reasons it's hard to make musicals today, is we don't know how.
Yeah.
They had teams of people to make musicals, so they bring in another voice because they go, oh, let's use this voice, because everyone's being paid, everyone's on contract.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, RF is like the worst studio head ever in the history of mankind. I mean, can we just like take a moment for that? Just flowing to whatever works, whatever goes around, whatever goes. Like, he's constantly in these situations. You're like, well, I don't even know who would make this decision. And like, he's always hiding stuff from other people, you know, those kinds of things. So it's just so fun.
Well, he's always just standing up for something and then completely crumbling.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So not what a studio head would do at all.
But which brings us to, because at the last moment, Kathy or Lena Lamont says, you know what? Kathy's got to continue to do my voice.
Yep.
And we can't let this out, and you can't let her be a star. Mm-hmm. And we have our big premiere, and things look pretty bad, and the movie's a big hit. And Lena wants to go, and she goes, Kathy, you're going to keep doing this for me. And Lena wants to go out and talk. And they go, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I can't tell you how thrilled we are at your reception for the Dancing Cavalier, our first musical picture together. Bless you all.
She didn't sound that way in the picture. Cut the talk, Lena, sing.
Yes, sir.
But it's a great circle, right? Because at the beginning,
they
three of them are
her
telling
talk.
Her not to talk.
Don't
you
talk.
Know, the publicity's got like, no, they want to love their stars, blah, blah, blah. And then she turns it around and goes, okay, if you're going to play this game, here's my contract, and she's got to stay being my voice, which almost works.
Almost.
Works.
Yeah.
And then they want her to sing.
Yeah.
And this moment is really mean.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty cruel, isn't it?
You got to do it, Kathy. This thing is too big.
Of course she's got to do it. She's got a 5-year contract with me. Get over to that microphone, Seldon.
You heard of Kathy. Now do it.
I'll do it, Don. I'll do it. But I never want to see you again, on or off the screen.
And it's so horrible. Yeah, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this unbelievable. And to the point where I adore the movie, but I'm kind of like, you know what? Not cool.
Yeah,
that is not. That's not. I understand you're going to have the reveal in the next moment, which they do, because Debbie Reynolds goes behind the curtain, Lena Lamont in front of the curtain. Lena Lamont starts singing in the Rain with Debbie Reynolds, and lip syncs to Debbie Reynolds in the background. And then in this really funny, joyful moment, Cosmo, RF, and Gene Kelly pull up the curtain, revealing the truth.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, and this is a good question. Why didn't he tell her? Do you think he didn't tell her because she wouldn't have agreed to be this cruel to her? Or do you think he didn't tell her because he just didn't want to tell her? Like he had his own plan, and screw what she was going to feel.
I think you want to know my reason why.
Well, I asked,
because the movie is more dramatic if you don't tell her.
I guess, that's a good point.
that's why you don't.
Well, also there was no time to convince. There's no time to convince. The crowd is out there screaming.
Yeah.
The, the diva is sure. walking on the stage. This is happening. And, you know, the three guys, they've somehow read each other's mind to collude into this mm-hmm. is going to be the solution. And so.
And I love Debbie Reynolds in tears. I don't love Debbie Reynolds in tears, right, but right. I love yeah. her running out into the audience.
Yeah.
And I love, stop that girl.
Yeah. yeah.
That's the girl, the voice you fell in love with. And that's when I start to cry.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Milena.
Yes.
Final thoughts on Singing in the Rain.
Man, Singing in the Rain just makes me love being a dancer and makes me want to dance more, even though I don't dance that often anymore. It just connects to the joy of performing and the joy that sparks singing and dancing when it's really coming from a true, authentic place. It can be the most transformative of performance experience. And I think Singing in the Rain is just the epitome of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. John, what about you?
Well, it's one of my favorite musicals ever, and it's Gene Kelly at top form. And, of course, a young Debbie Reynolds. Kathy Seldon was my first crush as a child.
It's good taste.
Yeah, and it's it's probably, I've been looking for that girl ever since. You know, the sweet, sarcastic, speaks her mind, but is very but willing to stand by you in your darkest times. So she's so great in the film, and Debbie's so radiant, and Donald O'Connor. There's just so many factors in the film that make it so great. But the number one thing to me is, for me, I fell in love with film by watching older films.
Right.
And this is a love letter to those older films. Yeah. As subversive as it is at times to make fun of the studio system, it doesn't make fun of the studio musicals. That you see how difficult these are to do, what's involved with the transition, all this. It's talking on a serious subject matter, like you said, Steve, this idea of like transitioning from silent to talkie. Who's going to lose their career? Who's not going to lose their career? How difficult it was. But it shows you, especially in the Broadway dance melody, you see that's their homage to those musicals. And right. those are the musicals that are the foundation for Singing in the Rain, for American in Paris, for what have you, for all the Fred Astaire. Like, all that stuff was there to get people's appetite wet for musical movies and keep it going, even to now with La La Land, which is a right. musical in essence. And so it's always going to be there. But those Busby Berkeley movies at the beginning of the studio system are the ones that lay the groundwork for all the musicals to come. And I think Singing in the Rain does a great job as a love letter to those kind of films.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agreed.
I was thinking about this quite a bit. If these episodes go out in the order that I think they will, the one that went out last week was No Country for Old Men.
Right.
Coen Brothers film. Great film, powerful, dark, won the best picture. And that's the kind of movie that Hollywood says that's a great film.
Yeah.
You know, like serious drama, bleak, tells you that life is essentially meaningless and dark. And that is a great film.
Yes.
And should get that respect.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reason it's called show business. There's a reason that it's called a play. And as we talked about with bleeding feet and sweat and all the hard work, is it's just as hard to give us joy as to give us bleakness.
Yeah.
Amen.
You know, and you know what? It's 2017 now, and 2016 was really hard, and we need this kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying we don't have serious movies. I love serious movies. I'm not saying film can't tell us important things about life, that it can't challenge us, that it can't make us a better people, but it can also make you smile.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more valuable than sitting down for a couple of hours and getting to smile a little bit
mm-hmm.
and feeling joy and feeling hope, you know?
And then it's a great point, Steve, because that's the double-sided coin of film. It is there to make you think and to change your views on the world. But on the flip side, it's there to help you escape the world when it gets too tough.
Absolutely.
And Singing in the Rain does that.
Yeah. And I would argue that in some cases, it's harder to have a joyful performance than mm-hmm. a more dark and dramatic performance.
Yeah.
It's easy to look at someone kind of putting on the smile.
Absolutely.
And you just go, ugh.
Yeah,
right.
You know, you have that saccharine taste in your mm-hmm. mouth from it. But when it's being really, really, truly well done and authentically done, it's so inspiring.
Yeah,
absolutely. No question about it. Well, we would like to hear what you think about Singing in the Rain. We hope you watch it. If you haven't seen it, watch it. Get your family together. Get some friends who haven't seen it before and sit down and watch it.
And it's great for kids, too.
Yes. Absolutely. If you have kids, sit them down and watch it, and maybe they'll get that same little spark in their eye. Maybe they'll want to go, I want to go dance. Right. And then they can have the bleeding feet and all the pain and suffering as well, too. And it, you know what? And it'll be worth it.
Yes.
And we'd love to hear what you think. So please, you can visit us on Facebook. That's The Cinephiles. It's CineFiles. But if you want to subscribe to us on Stitcher, you cannot use the dash because Stitcher doesn't like dashes. It's two words, C-I-N-E, no dash, files, F-I-L-E-S. Please search for us there. If you want to reach me, you can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter. John, where can they reach you?
You can always reach me at The Rocha Says, R-O-C-H-A. See all the shows I'm hosting and co-hosting and all the stuff I do all around town. And then also, please leave us comments on iTunes. Please, 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 please. Some of you who have listened to the Top 10 show, you guys did such a great job doing that for us. Do it for the Cinephiles, please. We really need it. Want to move up the chain. You guys have expressed so much joy at what we've been doing. And I think you can tell we're getting really, really tight doing this show. And so we want to get some feedback from you all so that we can keep going with this and possibly get sponsors and possibly get this thing like really subsidized.
I concur. Milena, if people want to reach you, is there a way for them to find you?
You can find me on all the socials at Milena Govich, M-I-L-E-N-A-G-O-V-I-C-H.
Excellent. And you should reach out to her and follow all the exciting things she's doing. There's a lot
yes,
of exciting news coming. And Milena, thank you so much
thank
for coming.
Thank you for having
it's
me. This
so great having
this
you.
This has been so much fun.
It's been great for us, too.
Yep.
And that's it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.